ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good evening and welcome to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan, coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. Tonight, Iran threatens to retaliate after the United States Navy attacks an Iranian container ship. Also, the Treasurer flags cuts to NDIS spending and the axing of property tax discounts in the May budget. And a new survey finds the happiness of Australians has declined in the last few years.
The Australian dream of owning a home, of having our kids go to good schools, of everyday living expenses being affordable. Now they're just not achievable.
In less than 48 hours, the shaky ceasefire in the Iran war will expire, but last-minute talks to reach a lasting peace deal are far from certain. It's unclear whether Iran is prepared to attend a second round of negotiations in Pakistan. And the interception of an Iranian-flagged cargo vessel by the US Navy has only further heightened tensions, with Iran threatening retaliation. Barbara Miller has this report.
Security has been stepped up in Pakistan's capital, Islamabad, as the city prepares to host a possible second round of negotiations between the US and Iran. But it's unclear if anyone will show up. Donald Trump announced he was sending a team to Pakistan, but Iran hasn't given any such commitment. State news channels say Tehran has no plans to attend another round of talks, citing ceasefire violations and the continued US blockade of ships entering and exiting Iranian ports. Things on that front have now ratcheted up a notch, with the US firing on and then seizing an Iranian-flagged cargo ship in the Gulf of Oman. The US military has released video of Marines rappelling onto the Tuska from a helicopter. Iran is vowing to respond and retaliate for what it calls a violation of the ceasefire and an act of armed piracy. Senior Trump officials were nevertheless talking up the prospect of a deal on the US Sunday talk shows. Here's former National Security Advisor, now UN Ambassador, Mike Waltz on CBS's Face the Nation.
The markets are up. Oil prices are relatively stable. The Iranian economy is devastated, and they've never been, I can tell you here at the United Nations, they've never been more diplomatically isolated. So Iran does not have the cards, and we are confident they will come to the table.
Energy Secretary Chris Wright was also bullish on Fox News Sunday.
Look, I think things are actually going quite well for the United States. I think we are not too far away from a deal, but of course these are the dying gasps of a desperate regime.
David Satterfield is a former U.S. ambassador to Turkey and to Lebanon. He told the BBC Donald Trump has two options if Iran doesn't show for the talks.
One is that he's patient. The blockade of the strait is clearly biting on Iran, and that blockade can continue indefinitely. We have the resources, the capability to do that. And he waits them out to see if, in fact, they do come back to the negotiating table. There is another option, though, which is that the president responds to a genuine refusal to come back to talks with an escalation of his own. That's problematic. Iran has the capacity to inflict very significant pain on the Gulf, theoretically on Israel as well, in response. And that is a cycle of escalation, which is one that will not yield a positive result for any party, any side.
Joe Kent, the man who resigned as the head of the National Counterterrorism Center over the Iran war, agreed that the first two options for what happens now were a negotiated settlement or a major escalation. In a post on X, Mr. Kent said there was, however, a third option, which he said Donald Trump should take. Recognize there's no way to force a positive outcome and simply leave. The region is not ours to fix, he wrote. A statement that will resonate with segments of the MAGA base not at all happy that their America First president seems to have got himself caught up in a foreign war. It's a real mess. If Donald Trump really just walks away, it's hard to see how he could claim a victory and there are no guarantees Iran would relinquish its grip on the Strait of Hormuz and therefore on the oil markets. Iranian news outlets are reporting that Iran is working on a new law on the governance of the strait, which would see tolls imposed and Israeli ships banned. That certainly wouldn't play well with Donald Trump's partner in arms, Benjamin Netanyahu, who's feeling the heat domestically for agreeing to a ceasefire with Lebanon. Shops and offices in the northern Israeli city of Kiryat Shmona remained closed in protest at the deal, with many Israelis calling for Israel's attacks on Hezbollah to continue. Now there's a ceasefire and everyone is grateful for the calm, but on the other hand, very, very disappointed, says this local resident. Nothing was achieved. With Donald Trump facing midterms in November and Benjamin Netanyahu elections by October, there's a lot hanging in the balance.
Barbara Miller reporting. Transport and grocery businesses are warning that the fuel crisis is going to push food prices even higher in Australia's most remote communities. They're warning that some routes through the Northern Territory, WA and Queensland may soon be economically unviable, and that has residents of remote communities worried about their continued access to food and fuel. Jane Barden has more.
Living 4 hours' drive from the nearest town, Boulmin Indigenous community leader John Dalywater says residents are already struggling to afford food and diesel costing more than $4 a litre.
Prices have been so high out in community, but with business going up.
He says the NT Central Arnhem Land community is very worried that the fuel crisis could stop trucks bringing in food and diesel.
It is a big worry. It's a big headache out here. You know, we've got a diesel generator. If that's going to go run low, then we're totally out of power. Then there's a panic out here.
He's worried governments won't prioritise remote areas if food and fuel shortages become severe.
I'm pretty sure they'll never look after the communities. They'll focus on in around the cities.
The NT Road Transport Association Executive Officer Louise Bellotto says companies trucking to remote communities are also worried.
Our remote communities have to be given a priority when you're talking about feeding a remote community or servicing remote community businesses.
Ms. Bellotto says for trucking companies struggling with higher fuel prices, the federal government's no-cost loan commitment will help. But she says companies are already having to pass on big fuel price rises to remote customers. And she's worried some remote routes may become completely uneconomic.
Where there's fixed price contracts in place, I mean, it's almost not worth those trucking operators to go and do the job and incur a loss and then essentially, you know, put themselves out of business.
The Seaswift Barge Company, which services many remote parts of the NT in Queensland, told the ABC it's had to raise prices for customers and it's advocating for ongoing fuel supply. Alistair King heads the Arnhem Land Progress Association, which runs 27 remote NT and Queensland grocery stores. He says they're absorbing some extra transport costs, but still have to pass on increased food supply costs of up to 10% and higher prices at remote fuel bowsers.
We are selling diesel out at Ramanginning at $4.40 a litre. We softened the blow by reducing the margin on it, but we had to put the price in or we'd be selling it at a loss.
He's calling on the federal government to consider sea freight subsidies and to prioritise remote fuel supplies.
I'm really worried. We must have fuel to be able to operate effectively, and our freight providers must have fuel to be able to deliver food and essentials to our communities.
In Western Australia, Tim Schneider heads the KJ Mardu Indigenous Organisation, which runs ranger programs in the East Pilbara. He's concerned that if their fuel runs low, staff could lose jobs just as life is becoming more expensive.
We want government to really look at this seriously. We're worried about the impact it's going to have just simply on, you know, the employment because a slowdown in the programs will cause a lot of Māori not to have money to be able to spend in the shop or to put fuel in their cars if they can even get any.
Indigenous organisations, including the Territory's land councils, are calling on the federal government to increase remote welfare payments to help communities cope with higher prices. Federal Indigenous Australians Minister Melindiri McCarthy says she's asking her Canberra colleagues to consider that.
And I will certainly be taking that back to Canberra and speaking with my colleagues.
And she's encouraging them to ensure remote area fuel security is a priority.
We're already considering remote regions as absolutely critical, and I'm certainly making sure my colleagues know very much what's going on in remote Australia.
Melindiri McCarthy is the Federal Minister for Indigenous Australians. Jane Barden with that report. Despite the global economic uncertainty, the Treasurer is continuing to describe next month's federal budget as ambitious. Today, Jim Chalmers conceded, though, that his original fiscal plans have been adapted because of the war in the Middle East. And when it comes to budget savings measures, he revealed the National Disability Insurance Scheme will be a key focus. Tanya Dendrinos has more.
In 3 weeks' time, Treasurer Jim Chalmers will deliver his fifth federal budget.
There'll be tax reform, there'll be a productivity push, and there will be savings. And cutting compliance costs is a big focus of the government and a big focus of the budget as well.
The Treasurer says the savings package will be substantial, but has changed from what was being considered earlier in the year, factoring in global economic uncertainty as a result of the war in the Middle East. He says Australia is hostage to the decisions being taken in Washington and Tehran.
Well, the excise cut, we think, is in the middle $2 billion. We'll present that in the budget. It'll be one of the bigger new spending items in the budget, no doubt, at that cost.
There's been plenty of speculation the government will cut the capital gains tax discount. Jim Chalmers says those decisions will be revealed on budget night.
There's more work to do on our options for tax reform in this budget. We have been really upfront for some time now in saying that we do think that there is intergenerational unfairness in the tax system and in the housing market.
Nationals leader Matt Canavan voiced his scepticism about the government's approach.
I think this government's got its priorities all wrong. Why is it focusing on arcane elements of the tax law when we don't have enough fuel to power our country the next few months?
His coalition counterpart, opposition leader Angus Taylor, seemingly in lockstep, delivering an address to the Chamber of Minerals and Energy of Western Australia today.
We must get the budget back under control so we can start to pay down our national debt. We must become a more resilient and self-reliant country. It's time to dig, to drill, and to pay down the debt bill.
But today, a group of more than 50 community sector organisations released a joint statement saying they believe tax reform, among other measures, is critical in this budget. Dr Cassandra Goldie is the CEO of the Australian Council of Social Service.
We certainly want to see the raising of revenue, 25% levy on those gas exports, which would generate about $17 billion and mean that the Australian community got some benefit. And secondly, we do want to see those property investor tax breaks rolled back to make sure that we are raising the right kind of revenue and also that we are helping to tackle the housing affordability crisis.
Lucy Ellis is the chief economist at Westpac. She believes changes to the capital gains tax are likely in this budget.
It's sounding more likely than I thought a few months ago. I've previously advocated for going back to a simplified version of the pre-1999 system, where instead of indexing to the inflation rate, you just index to 2.5%, which is the midpoint of the RBA's target. And that would have some benefits in terms of not making people prefer assets that generate capital gains rather than income.
What are some of the other measures you think are necessary or would be beneficial to Australians?
When I speak with leaders of business, it's not tax they complain about, it's regulation. They want to take advantage of new technology like AI. That's also a big topic of conversation. But the thing that they would love government to do rather than tax reform is actually make it easier and faster and cheaper to comply with the many permissions and regulations that different layers of government require.
Today, Treasurer Jim Chalmers revealed the most important part of the government's budget savings package will be reform to the National Disability Insurance Scheme.
Our highest priority in the NDIS is providing a high standard of support and care, and that means we need to be able to pay for it. The NDIS is growing too fast for Australians to afford.
The Treasurer will meet with his state and territory counterparts tomorrow afternoon to discuss the measures, alongside Health Minister Mark Butler, who will address the press club on Wednesday, speaking about NDIS reform. The Treasurer promising the Health Minister will provide more detail than usual in advance of the federal budget.
Tanya Dendrinos. This is PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. Just a reminder, you can hear all our programs live or later on ABC Listen. The New South Wales government is considering introducing anti-hate speech laws similar to those in Queensland to help promote social cohesion. The move comes after the New South Wales Court of Appeal rejected anti-protest laws introduced by the Minns government after the Bondi terror attack. Under the Queensland legislation, protesters face up to 2 years in jail if they use the phrases "from the river to the sea" or "globalise the intifada." But lawyers question whether that reform is having much effect, particularly after a recent protest. Kathleen O'Connor filed this report.
Dressed in denim and wearing mullet wigs, pro-Palestinian protesters gathered in Brisbane, singing along to the 90s hit song "Two Strong Hearts" by John Farnham, using the song lyrics "from the river to the sea" to defy the Queensland government's ban on the controversial phrase. Those who recite or display the slogan face up to 2 years in jail. No one was arrested. The next day, the same phrase was used again in a speech at another protest. Alla Guttridge from Students for Palestine was one of 20 people arrested and charged by police.
I was taken to the watch house and held for about 8 hours, and then I was forced to sign a bail condition that said I wouldn't be able to attend the Palestine rally the next day.
The sweeping anti-hate speech laws passed through the Queensland Parliament in early March and are expected to be challenged by protest groups. Now, the New South Wales Premier Chris Minns says he's considering banning the slogans at protests in his state.
I think that hateful phrase has been exposed as exactly what it is. It's not a call for peace or unity. It's not a call for multiculturalism or understanding. It's not even a civil rights or social justice call, in my view. It's about globalising hatred.
Just last week, New South Wales's highest court struck down the state's controversial anti-protest laws introduced in the wake of the Bondi terror attack. The Court of Appeal found the laws, which meant that protesters couldn't march without the risk of arrest, were unconstitutional. Three prominent protest groups challenged the government's legislation. The Premier says he doesn't regret introducing the laws.
That legislation was absolutely crucially important in ensuring that we navigated a difficult summer. And I'm not saying there wasn't clashes, and I'm not saying it wasn't difficult, but I don't regret moving that legislation at all. I think it was absolutely imperative and important for New South Wales.
Bart Steinman is the executive officer at the Jewish Council of Australia.
From the river to the sea is categorically not an anti-Semitic phrase. It's a call for freedom and equality. We've been seeing these anti-protest laws long before October 7th. We've got a situation now where governments have found in the Jewish community a useful scapegoat and excuse to pass an authoritarian set of laws that they've always wanted to bring into place. And I think that's incredibly dangerous for social cohesion in this country. And it needs to be stopped.
However, other prominent Jewish groups have strongly supported toughening up hate speech laws in New South Wales and Queensland and the banning of those specific slogans. Greg Barnes SC is a human rights lawyer and a member of the Australian Lawyers Alliance. He says it's inevitable that these types of laws will be challenged in state courts.
There is and has been for the last 30-odd years now what's called an implied freedom of political communication. In other words, it's not a right that people have in Australia, unlike the United States, for example, but there are limits to the way in which governments can legislate in this area, because political communication is extremely important. It's the fabric of our democracy.
He says banning a phrase with a contested meaning will never work.
There's a very, very big difference between chanting from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free, and a slogan which says, all Aboriginal people or all black people in Australia should be deported. The latter is clearly hate speech. The former is not. And so governments need to be very, very careful and resist the temptation, despite what lobby groups want them to do, to be legislating in an area that is fundamental to our democracy, and that is freedom of speech.
Greg Barnes, SC, from the Australian Lawyers Alliance. Kathleen O'Connor reporting. Well, here's a question for you. Are you satisfied with your life? An Australian National University poll asks nearly 4,000 people for their answer to that query several times a year. And in the latest results, the researchers have found Australians are less satisfied with their lives now than they were during the COVID lockdowns. Kimberly Price reports.
On a sunny day in Melbourne centre, people had plenty to smile about.
What contributes to my happiness is family, nature, and I guess having enough money to live comfortably. I don't need a lot of money.
Looking after myself and being holistic, and whether that be in what I do when I'm at work, and outside of work, and making sure that there's a balance there.
Seeing each other every day.
Yeah. Sunshine.
Definitely sunshine.
But it's not all sunshine and rainbows, with many acknowledging they are struggling with a range of issues.
We're trying to save up for a house at the minute, and it's quite hard to save, get the full deposit.
And say with the conflict going on and how prices are going up even more, petrol, people can't always afford things.
These factors and many others are contributing to the average life satisfaction in adult Australians falling to its lowest level since the COVID pandemic. That's the finding from the Australian National University's recent poll, which surveyed just over 3,600 adults.
So we've got almost 30 waves of data now going back to late 2019. This is the first time life satisfaction is down in the 6.2s on a scale of 0 to 10.
Professor Nick Biddle led the survey and is head of the School of Politics and International Relations at ANU.
During the lockdowns, there were greater drops in life satisfaction. So between January and April 2020, there was quite a large drop, but that was from a relatively high base. So what we've seen in our data is that while there's been fluctuations, there's been kind of a slow trend downwards.
The poll was conducted in March this year, and Professor Biddle admits the data could be skewed because of the recent conflict in the Middle East. However, he says the downward trajectory of satisfaction paints a different picture.
I think it's more about people's current experience, but also their expectations about the short-term future.
The study has found, for the first time, more Australians are dissatisfied with the direction of the country than satisfied, and nearly 3 in 5 believe life was better 50 years ago. Financial stress is also at a record high, and people fear losing their jobs at the same rate they did during the COVID pandemic, despite the unemployment rate now being lower. Professor Biddle says he was surprised about the level of those dissatisfied with life.
So across multiple indicators over just a very short period of time, so between December last year and March of this year, quite substantial deterioration in wellbeing outcomes.
The paper concludes that future surveys will need to be studied to see if the downward trends in economic, security and institutional pressures continue.
I think that these results are very much reflective of what a lot of psychologists are seeing across the board all over Australia.
Sarah O'Doherty is the president of the Australian Association of Psychologists.
What we know from COVID is COVID completely changed the way that we lived and worked and interacted with people. And this extends further into what we might call, you know, the Australian dream of owning a home, of having our kids go to good schools, of everyday living expenses being affordable. These expectations have been set up to be things that were adequately achievable by our parents and our grandparents' generations. And now they're just not achievable.
Sara O'Doherty says to counter dissatisfaction with life, there needs to be a realignment of expectations.
Look at what is actually realistic and achievable in today's climate compared to the kinds of expectations that we might have been fed as kids.
Sara O'Doherty is the president of the Australian Association of Psychologists. Kimberly Price with that report. Thanks for joining me for PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. The podcast of the full program is available on ABC Listen. And we'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Good night.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Over the past 8 years, the diagnosis of ADHD has surged among Australian adults, especially among women. Today, Norman Swan on his Four Corners investigation into data that's never been collated before and whether it shows ADHD is being overdiagnosed. Look for the ABC News Daily Podcast on ABC Listen.